So thank you, Ramesh. We thought we'd start each session with just a brief meditation as a way to underline the theme of Get Unbusy. All of these meditations that we'll do at the beginning of this class and the meditations that we'll be teaching next week at Pure Yoga weekend course, all of these are for busy people who, you know, maybe don't have time to like do a half an hour or 45 minutes every morning, but you can do meditations like the one that we'll do now and the one that Cindy led yesterday and the ones that we'll teach you over the course of the next week at any time during the day. When you start to feel like jangled or nervous or something like that, you can take 2 minutes, 5 minutes, and just do a meditation like this, okay? So get into your proper relaxed posture. The most important thing is to have your back straight. If you're sitting on a chair, to have your feet on the ground. Close your eyes. Take a few deep breaths and just let all attention go. Settle in. Just start from the head and work down and relax every part of your body. Relax your forehead. Any tension you're holding in your forehead, relax your eyes. Relax your cheeks, your mouth, your neck, your shoulders, your torso, your stomach, your legs. Make sure you're not holding any tension in any part of your body. Then relax your mind. Stop thinking about what's already happened and stop thinking about what could happen in the future. Let go of all worry and stress. Be here now. And right now there's nothing to do. There's nothing that you need to do. You're sitting in a yoga studio relaxed. The phones are all off. There's nothing to check. So give your mind a vacation, a holiday, and just relax. Notice where you are. You are in Oasis Holistic, in a yoga studio. Use your own like inner GPS. Locate yourself in space. You're in this yoga studio, you're in Singapore, you're in Asia, you're on planet Earth. And then notice when you are. You're not an hour ago, you're not 2 weeks ago, you're not a week from now. You are here, now, in the present. So notice what's happening in the present. Listen to the sounds of the present. Feel the air around you. Pay attention to any smells that you can smell in the present. And just notice that everything's okay. Nobody's just been hit by a truck. Nobody's in excruciating pain. Nothing to do. No stress. No anxiety. Everything's fine here and now. So relax. Maybe intentionally, slowly, without too much effort, slow down your breathing. Relaxed, our breath is very slow and fine. So you can help yourself relax by manipulating your breath a little bit. So give that a go. Give yourself a break. Then slowly try to come back, open your eyes, and bring that sense of relaxation into your life now, into the next hour and a half, 2 hours or so of the class. Okay, easy, right? Easy. Anyone can do it. And you can do it at any time. It doesn't take long. How long did I do? 3 minutes, maybe? Right? And it makes a difference. It makes a difference in your life. We have to learn these kinds of survival skills now, you know, in order to not lose our minds in the kind of life that we're all leading. So you can do that. You can do that at any time during the day. So I think we'll start with a little review. Cindy will review what we did last night a little bit, and then we'll forge ahead.
Okay, welcome everybody. Who was here last night? Okay, good. Oh, good. All right. Yeah, because it's good if, you know, I sort of lead the review, but also you remind yourself of what you heard. So, first of all, this is about get unbusy. And remember, the subtitle is Defecting from the Cult of Busyness. And Marut was talking yesterday about busyness being cult-like, almost like religious fervor. Remember that? So when we sort of have this compulsion to say that we're busy because it, you know, we relate it to our self-esteem. We have exhaustion as a status symbol. Exhaustion as a status symbol. When someone calls you and says, "How are you?" and you say, "Oh my God, I'm so busy." That's sort of like cult-like, like religious fervor of you having this great self-esteem about being so busy because you relate it to your own importance, your own self-esteem, right?
Salvation through busyness.
Salvation through busyness. So the first bit was really just defining busyness. And then the second part of the teaching, we were looking at why we're so busy. So I thought we could do, like yesterday, crowdsource busyness. And I wanted to know what you remember or what you maybe thought of overnight about why you personally are staying so busy, or anything that you heard last night that you really responded to, that you know moves you, gives you that compulsion to stay busy. Ramesh?
One of the thoughts which came to me when I was going back yesterday was like worrying about health and parents' health.
Mm-hmm. And why does that keep you busy?
Imminent, like, oh, I should call them, or I should check on them, or I should, to the extent that, if you don't do it, it's like some sort of restlessness. I did notice that.
Yes. Yep. Okay, good. So the compulsion
that
we're talking about. Yes, worry and anxiety. Yep.
Worry and anxiety.
Yeah, compulsion.
You know that term, helicopter parenting? You're a helicopter son.
I think it's right. Stress and anxiety, you know, the continual stress and anxiety keeps us feeling very busy. Anyone else? Yes?
I think it's hard to say no.
Hard to say
feeling
no.
Guilty.
Yes.
Oh, we're going to address that today.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. And so we talked a little bit about creating some boundaries. So trying to create some boundaries in your work life and personal life around when you're contactable and when you're going to be available to email. So trying to be able to create some sanity in your life through boundary making around when you're working, because the smartphone has made you available all the time. Jay? Asana? Ladies first.
I realized that it's possible to even have experienced something like yoga stress.
Mm.
Even to live in Bali and teach just way too much yoga every day.
Yes.
Can flip out of the balance.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. Actually, I got a quote about the busyness, sort of like an aggression, that we overlay onto all aspects of our life, and so people now have yoga injuries or sports injuries. Like the book I was reading, they were talking about how their friend was injured in yoga because the teacher pushed them down into the splits, because you've got to get into the splits today, you know. And so that sort of busyness of like you've got to get to the top immediately, and so we push ourselves in our leisure and our, you know, spiritual life, that we continually push ourselves to be busy, to achieve. We bring all of that stress that we might bring in our work into our spiritual life, and people get injured, and mentally injured and emotionally injured and so on, because we don't have the sort of expansiveness of appreciating the slowness of the journey. Yeah.
If you're stressed out in your spiritual life, it's no longer a spiritual life.
Chuck, were you going to say something?
I find that sometimes at home that talking about doing things repetitively or doing things so you don't have to engage in the presence, right? So I'm always like fiddling and fixing and cleaning and moving things around, right? So I don't have to engage in the actual moment, right?
Filling
those little uncomfortable times with, the pepper shaker's not turned the right direction. OCDC. I bet you there's loose pepper grains under the pepper shaker.
Right.
There is. Yeah, then I'll have to engage with whatever's going on around me.
So Marie was talking about how when he has one thing to do, everything else gets done. It might be something like that. But also there was the part in the talk yesterday where we were speaking about how many of us keep ourselves so busy because if we stopped being busy, we would realize what we were running away from.
Yeah, correct. That's what I'm saying.
That's right.
Maybe I'm just afraid to engage with the present moment. Right?
Yeah.
So if I'm always running from it, then...
Absolutely.
Then I don't have to.
Right.
Well, busyness is kind of a drug. It's like, you know, alcohol or any other kind of drug. It can keep us from focusing on, you know, reality, actually, on what's actually happening in our lives and, you know, purpose of our lives and all like that. It can be escapism.
Yes.
Yeah, busyness is escapism.
Yeah. So good. We also talked about samsara being nothing other than having the feeling that there's something that needs to be done.
Compulsion.
Yes, sorry.
I know. Yesterday, after you guys talked, so I thought, okay, maybe look at models of busy and active. So I thought to myself, no, my dog's pretty active, but he's not very busy looking. But then, upon observing him through this morning, I noticed that when he hears sounds in the kitchen going on, like there's food being cooked or something like that, right, he starts scratching at the door and yelping and going, yep, yep. So I'm wondering, that's not really so unbusy, because, you know, he's thinking he might get left out.
Yes.
Of scraps.
Yes.
Stuff like that. So I'm thinking to myself, it's very possible that what I supposedly lead a reasonably unbusy life, I have a suspicion that there are times where, you know, it just flare up and tell me,
yes, we flail around without even knowing it, just like a dog. Is that what you said? Yeah. So it's true. It's true. Habitual action rather than awakened. Habitual reaction rather than awakened action.
Rather than that, I realized, hey, what's happening? I always thought I was like this, but then the action is there.
Yeah. You know, actually, I realized this with my dog, that he got taken on a walk every day. You know, we definitely were going to take him on a walk every single morning. That's what's going to happen every morning. But every morning, we'd wake up and then the, like, anticipation would start. And that, you know, he'd start with a little, like, I'm here, you know, ready, anytime, ready. We're ready anytime. And you'd make a coffee and he's like, oh, you know, are you making a coffee? I have to start, like, begging. And, you know, and then he'd, like, you'd make your breakfast and, like, oh, my God. You know, they're making breakfast, they haven't taken me in a while, I better start knocking on the door. And, you know, he would do this every morning, like getting more and more, like, freaking out. Like, why aren't we on a walk? You know, but we went on a walk every morning. And I really thought to myself that he thinks that all of that is why we go on the walk, you know. But we were always going to go on the walk. You know, we never didn't go on the walk. But he thinks... that he has to freak out for 2 hours and then we'll go on a walk, you know. So, the Dharma of dogs. So lastly...
Teachers come in off on.
That's right. So lastly, one of the things we were talking about was, remember FOMO and FOF? And these two anxieties are really being displayed through now a lot through social media. So, yes, because we're too busy to say fear of missing out. We say FOMO, but FOMO means fear of missing out. So fear of missing out means that sometimes we remain busy because we have a fear of missing out on pleasant experiences. So this is how we get a little deeper into our, you know, our stress-based body, our survival instinct body, our habitual response body, which runs on a fear of missing out on pleasurable experiences. This is one of our primal instincts, right? FOMO. Fear of missing out on pleasurable experiences is one of the major energies that run our life when we're not conscious of it. We allow to run our life, right? Raga. Fear of missing out on pleasurable experiences. So in terms of social media, you know, like I said yesterday, you see Jackie's put up her picture of Angkor Wat and you think, oh my God, Jackie's gone to Angkor Wat. I haven't been to Angkor Wat, you know. What's going to happen if I don't go to Angkor Wat? You know, I'm missing out on some pleasurable experience that Jackie's having. Maybe she got enlightened at Angkor Wat. I'm not going to, you know, freaking out like the dog. And what's so interesting about FOMO, fear of missing out, is that you're missing out on the pleasant experiences of the present moment, right? You can't be available for what's happening right now. You can't enjoy what's happening right now because you're throwing yourself into the pleasant experience that you're missing out on that Jackie's having. So FOMO is so ironic. You have a fear of missing out on pleasant experiences and therefore you miss out on the experience of living here and now, which is the only pleasant experience you could possibly have. Living here and now, you know, that's where your experience is. So fear of missing out, and then what's FOF?
Fear of failure.
So the other primal energy that runs us is a fear of pain, a natural evolutionary response, because there was so much danger, you know, in our sort of evolutionary cellular structure, there was so much danger that we run on fight, flight, freeze. We have a fear of pain. We have a fear of failure. So that's another reason we keep so busy. And I think we were talking about the fact that we have such a fear of failure that we stay busy not doing the one thing that we really feel passionate about doing. Do you remember this? We have such a fear of failure of doing the thing that we really keep so sacred in ourselves. I think yesterday's example was I really want to join the circus, you know. And everyone laughed, and that's the exact example of why you don't want to tell anyone. Because it's so precious to you and people think it's ridiculous, or you were told as a kid that's a stupid goal, you're never going to make it. You know, so the very passion that we have of what we really want to do to express our gifts in the world, we have a fear of failure of that. So we do everything else really well maybe too. Or we do other people's jobs really well, which brings us to the next part of the class yesterday, which was doing what is there to be done. And you remember this verse from the Bhagavad Gita that we stalled out on because it's so magnificent. It is better to do one's own duty imperfectly than to do the duty of another well. It is even better to die doing one's own duty. The duty of another is perilous. So that relates to that fear of failure as well. I don't know if this has been something in your life, but in mine certainly, like I was able to throw myself into other people's projects, other people's creative projects and so on, because it wasn't mine and I was so afraid of putting myself out there because I might fail doing it, and so I would do someone else's job really well. Put all my creative energy, you know, into doing something for someone else but not really address my own passion. So remember, we were talking about the three kinds of dharma, the way that you can find your dharma in the world. And the context of that was really knowing your priorities, getting your priorities clear so that you know how to act, so that you know where to put that precious time and energy that you have per day. Every day we have only so many thoughts that we can think. We have so many actions we can perform. We have only so many breaths that we can take. Only so much energy that we can put into things every day. And so we need to be able to prioritize. And the way that you prioritize is knowing what your dharma is. Remember? Knowing your dharma. What is your dharma? So what were the three kinds of ways that we could think about finding our dharma? Svadharma? Kula dharma? Sanatana dharma. Right. When we can find these three sort of perspectives so that we really understand what our dharma is, we know how to prioritize, we know where to put our energy, and we know how to stop ourselves from getting distracted from our dharma. One of the things that we were talking about yesterday was mindfulness. And Marut was saying, you know, mindfulness is the ability to stay present for what's happening, right? Remember, mindfulness is the ability to stay present for what's happening. But also you could say that that as well, we really need to train on what is worthy of our attention and what is not worthy of our attention. You know, because what's happening, there's a whole bunch of stuff happening. And again, Facebook is a fabulous example of this. So I go on Facebook to, I got to email Jackie, right? So I better go on Facebook to email Jackie. Oh, but I'll just check the feed. Oh, there's a cat. Oh, what did Donald Trump say today? Yeah. Oh, someone I don't even know that got married. I'll look at their photos. And an hour goes by and what have I forgotten to do? Email Jackie, you know. It's like, do you walk down the street to get milk and then you see a cat and you just follow it down the road, you know? Or you see someone get married and you just turn up at their wedding. You know, it's crazy. It's crazy that we do that on Facebook. And it's because we have not trained our attention. We skip over things like, you know when you throw a stone across the water and it just skips like that? The attention just bounces on everything, and especially the things that have lights and music and cats, and you think that that's worthy of your attention. Oh, but it's pretty, you know. Oh, but there's colours in it. Oh, it's moving. And we skip like a stone skipping along it because we have not learnt how to filter out irrelevancy. It's not relevant to do that now because what I'm doing is emailing Jackie. With my precious time and energy from the morning, I have to communicate with my friend about our lunch or whatever, you know? And so mindfulness and the ability to know what your dharma is helps us prioritize and know where to put our energy, right? So that we're not, and that, because when I have an email Jackie after an hour, I feel busy. I feel too busy to email her because I've spent an hour doing other things. Yeah. And immediately I feel too busy. Oh my God, I've got to call, you know, email Jackie. It could have taken 5 minutes, but it's taken an hour and 5 minutes. And I feel too busy, overwhelmed. So your dharma, svadharma. So yesterday, and there's many ways to interpret all of this, but yesterday we really looked at svadharma as a way to get in touch with your passions, your proclivities, your interests, right? We were looking at as well, like what inspires you or other people that inspire you. They inspire you because maybe that's something that you feel called to do. Or even like people that you're a bit jealous of, because jealousy shows you when you sort of think, oh, they shouldn't be doing that, I could do that much better. Actually, that's because you want to do it. They're really, if you could move through jealousy like that, you recognize that people that you're jealous of are your gurus, because that's what you want to do. See, so you can find your passion through those emotions that you have. So svadharma. We were talking about this actually this morning at breakfast because I'll share something personal, sorry. I didn't ask for permission. But it's really interesting because when we first started teaching together, I used to get really nervous, like really, really nervous. Just feel sick and, you know, part of my mind was just like, oh my God, I hope the building falls down, and, you know, like that, like freaking out like the dog. You know, very, very nervous about it. And then, you know, when I asked him, do you get nervous? It's like, no. In no way does he get nervous. But then recently we've been playing music together. I sing and play piano and he plays guitar. And all of a sudden it's reversed. So I can sit up in front of everybody and sing and I don't feel nervous at all, even though I'm not like a fantastic singer, but I don't know. I can just do it. And he shakes playing his guitar. You know, he gets nervous. So I thought this was a really interesting way to... Yeah, your handshake. Sorry. No, but you get nervous, right? Yeah.
Strumming pattern.
Yeah, yeah.
You need fast ones.
But anyway, when we were discussing it this morning, you know, we were talking about the fact that maybe that relates to what your dharma is too, because in some cases you feel confident about it and you feel as though it's sort of your calling and you don't care so much if people don't like it because you're really passionate about it, you know. So that's one way to think about your dharma. Then when we moved to Kula Dharma, we also looked at the fact that sometimes you were born into a family, like I was born into a family of performers, and no matter how much I tried to escape from it, it's kind of my dharma too, you know. So you can also think about your duties and your proclivities in terms of like what kind of family were you born into or what kind of community were you born into, your responsibilities toward your community and your family, and also the fact that we were born sons, daughters, or we've had kids and so on. That's the clear responsibilities that you have. And Sanatana Dharma is then beyond the personal to the sort of transpersonal of what were you put here on earth to do spiritually? You know, your Sanatana Dharma is really recognizing your true nature, recognizing the interconnectivity of all phenomena, recognizing that you're part of the galactic network, you know, the cosmic network of love and connection. Now that's a pretty good dharma to have, right? That's a pretty good priority to have, is to connect every day to truth, to your true self and the truth of reality. You know, your Sanatana Dharma is to get in touch with reality. And so that's a priority, right? And then lastly, this part of the verse about doing your own duty imperfectly rather than doing the duty of another well is sort of a nice way to just remind us that, you know, we do only have a short amount of time to be on earth, and how about expressing ourselves in the most messy, vulnerable, embarrassing, you know, failing way possible, but knowing we lived our lives. Not that we lived someone else's life, that we lived like what we thought other people should, you know, what other people think we should do, but really found our dharma and expressed it. And no matter how many times you fail, no matter how many times you're laughed at or whatever, but how good would it be to know you lived your life? And I think if you look at literature on people that are dying, that is one of the regrets. I wish that I'd done my passion, I wish I'd lived my life, you know, because so many of us hide. I think, what's that poem? When you let your own light shine, you unconsciously give others permission to do the same. So many times we close it off, we're too embarrassed to show that, but really that's what we want to do, right? We want to express the gifts, we want to express the universe through our body, speech and mind. And so that would be a good way to live your dharma. Not live somebody else's idea of what you should do. You know, we're all grown-ups now, right? We've all been guided in certain ways as kids, and that's fine, but that would be a good way to live, I think. Yeah.
All right, so we'll forge ahead now to class two. This class we've entitled Getting Organized. So part of the project of getting unbusy is to get organized so that... So that we have our priorities in order. So this whole class is about how to get those priorities in order. And I think everyone will have slightly different understandings of what their own priorities are, but it's important to know what they are. It's important to figure it out. And there's one real easy test for this. and we'll come back to it in the middle of the class, and it'll be the exercise for this class. One real easy way to figure out what your priorities are, and that is to remember death. To remember the fact that you are mortal. Anyone here not immortal? Not mortal? Immortal? Anyone? A superhero? Anybody? So we all will die. That's for sure, okay? That's not debatable, is it? It's like, anyone want to like say, no, I'm not going to die. But, you know, so we all know this intellectually, but this is the one thing that we know for sure and the one thing that we really don't want to think about. How does that make sense? The one thing that we know in the future for sure will happen is something that we avoid thinking about at all costs. It makes no sense, right? So realizing that your life is finite, that you only have a certain amount of hours in your life, and a bunch of them have already passed. Have you noticed? Right? You only have a finite number, and a lot of them have already gone. So, you know, get clear. What do you want to do with the rest of your time? And there's not that much left for anyone, okay? And for some of us, it could be very short. You know, you could die tomorrow. Any one of us could die tomorrow. Could die today, actually. You know, no guarantees, right? So that's really a good way to get clear, really quick, on what's important here, you know? What's important to do with your life? So that's the class, really. So we can all go home now, really. You know, you figure it out. You figure out, like, what's important. So yesterday I said that we were not time management consultants. And that these classes are not about managing time. But today I'm going to reverse myself and say, no, actually we are time management consultants. But it's not like the 10 tips for how to be productive or whatever the hell those books are, you know. you know, the 10 tips that successful people use to, like, make a lot of widgets. This is spiritual time management from the spiritual point of view, right? Prioritizing what's important, and what is most important in all of our lives is our spiritual life. And that's kind of important to get clear. Another part, well, you know, Cindy will go through the death awareness meditation in detail, but another part of it is to think, what's going to matter when I die? You know? It's not a matter of if. When I die, what's going to really matter? You see? What will I look back on my life and say, like, you know, I either was successful or not successful at it? And it's not going to be about how much money you made. It's not going to be about what kind of cars you drive. It's not going to be about how cool your flat is. You see? It's not even going to be about how many friends you had. It's going to be about, did you do your best to live a good life? That's what's going to matter. So that's spiritual. That's what spirituality means. Trying to live a good life. So, prioritizing what's important. And another like way, and then we'll look at some verses from the ancient texts that can guide us a little bit. Another way to implement what you decide is important in your life, and to prioritize and implement it, is to decide it's important. You see? We do what we think is important to do in life. Actually. We all do what we think is important to life. You see? Like, you know, if you have a plane to catch, to get to a very important meeting in Hong Kong, you prioritize that, right? You make sure that you get up in time and that you figure out the travel time to the airport so that you don't miss the plane. If you think it's important enough, you'll do it. I used to have a dentist in Los Angeles. He was kind of like the dentist to the stars. You know, he was a real classy dentist guy. You could only get an appointment with him, like, you know, a year in advance or something like that. So you make your appointment a year. You are damn sure that you made that appointment, you know? You prioritized it. You didn't, like, space out, you know? It took you a year to get in to see the guy, so you were there on time, you know, right? So we do what we think is important to do. So why is it that we don't think that the spiritual life is important? So when we talk about the prioritizing, you know, number one should be your spiritual development. And this is what they, and realizing that and then really working hard for it. This is the first part of the class. So these are verses, we'll start with verses from the seventh chapter of the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. I see many people in here who have gone through that whole text with me on retreat. So it'll be a reminder for some of you, okay? The Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, classic text of Mahayana Buddhism. This is the beginning of the seventh chapter. There's a whole chapter out of 10 chapters of this, you know, great, great spiritual classic. A whole chapter on what they call virya in Sanskrit. Virya. Joyful effort. Virya is a Sanskrit word that's related to English words like virile or virulent. Like you have a virulent strain of a disease. It means strong. It means powerful. It means like getting your back behind it. You know that expression? Get your back behind it. Get stoked also. You know, because it's not just like, it's not just working hard. It's working hard happily, which is the best way to work hard. Because then you really are interested in it, you see? We do a lot of hard work for stuff that we're really not that happy about. Many, many people put up with all kinds of difficulties for a job that they're really not that, you know, stoked about, right? Put up with the traffic, get up early in the morning, work long hours. I mean, we're, you know, we're not incapable of working hard. But if we really like doing something, we will work hard at it joyfully and harder, you could say even, right? So it's another part of like getting the priorities in order is to feel good about your spiritual efforts, you see? To feel like stoked about like maybe cultivating a good meditation practice or coming to the yoga studio on a regular basis or working hard to become a more honest, a more, you know, kind of moral person, you know? So it's not just what we think is important, but also what we really want that will help us work hard to get it. So this is, you know, a little motivational talk, right? How to get motivated to do what should be our number one priority in life. Learn how to be a better person. Develop ourselves spiritually. So these are the first verses. Once you have cultivated patience, that's because it's the coming right after the sixth chapter, which is all about patience or tolerance. Once you have cultivated patience, you should then begin the practice of joyful effort, virya. For awakening depends on making effort. Okay? Anyone unclear on that? Like, awakening here means, you know, freedom, perfect happiness, you know, enlightenment, whatever name you have for the goal of a spiritual life, which is, by the way, the goal of all our lives. It doesn't matter what you call it, but we all have the same goal, ultimately, see? Some people think that, well, you know, my goal is to make, you know, $1 million, or my goal is to become a CEO at the company, but underneath all of the apparent goals, the lesser goals, is the same goal. I want to be happy. We all want to be happy. And happiness, you know, real happiness, means satisfaction, contentment, right? Not, in other words, you could say real happiness involves not wanting anymore, right? not being dissatisfied all the time. So we all have that same goal. Every being has exactly the same two kinds of motivations in life. And that's not just human beings, but, you know, insects, animals, all kinds of living beings. They just want to be happy and avoid pain. And none of us are different. All the same on that. The great equality. We all just want to be happy and avoid pain. So once you've cultivated patience, you should then begin the practice of joyful effort. For awakening depends on making effort. You can't just, you know, wait around for the awakening fairy to come and, you know, bop you on the head with her little crystal wand and say, oh, you know, you don't worry about, don't do anything. You don't have to do anything. I'll just, like, take care of everything for you, see? Many of us are waiting for that fairy, aren't we? Just, you know, think like, well, you know, somehow I deserve it, but I don't have to work for it. So, you know, we're talking about being unbusy, but that doesn't mean inactive. Okay? Unbusy doesn't mean you just, like, are a slug. Especially when it comes to the spiritual life. You still have to make efforts. But joyful effort means without the stress, without the anxiety, without the competitiveness. So oftentimes that creeps into a spiritual life, doesn't it? In a yoga studio, you know, they're looking over at somebody else and seeing how well they're doing, and noticing how you're much better than they are, you know, like all that judgment and all of that. And not just yoga, by the way. All forms of dharma are like this, all forms of spiritual life. So without any of that competitiveness or stress or anxiety, to work hard, to make efforts. Awakening depends on making efforts. Just as nothing moves without wind, without effort, there is no merit made. Okay? So first verse of a whole chapter is saying, look, you've got to make some effort. You've got to work hard. If you're going to make progress spiritually in your life, you have to work hard. But not without the kind of, you know, stress, anxiety, and so forth that characterize a busy life. Can you work hard happily without that kind of stress and anxiety? And so hopefully we'll be able to convey, you know, ways to do that. Next verse. What is joyful effort? This is the, you know, second verse. So define virya for me. It is being happy about doing good things. Being happy about making efforts to improve yourself and to improve the lives of other people around you also. Being happy about it. The obstacles to it. Now, so now they come to it. How come we don't, like, prioritize and get really, like, motivated behind our spiritual life? In the same way that we do, for example, around our professional lives. You know, making all kinds of sacrifices, making all kinds of efforts in our professional lives, how come we can't bring even a fraction of that into our spiritual lives? Imagine how much progress we'd make spiritually if you brought even like 20% of the effort that you put into your professional lives. Or your education, you know? Years and years and years of training and homework and exams and all like that. If we put just a fraction of that kind of effort into our spiritual lives, we, you know, make an enormous progress really quickly. So why not? What are the obstacles to it? Laziness, number one. Attachment to contemptible things, number two. And depression or low self-esteem, number three. So we'll talk about laziness in a minute. I'll just cover the other two quickly. Attachment to contemptible things, you know, means getting diverted all the time. Getting diverted all the time. And we have lots of diversions in our lives nowadays, don't we? Lots of opportunity for diversion. You know, endlessly surfing the net, endlessly watching, you know, TV, going to the movies, entertaining ourselves. There's nothing wrong with it in moderation. Right? And it's important to have a certain amount of, you know, kind of downtime and entertainment in your lives. But entertainment now has become kind of an end in and of itself. There was a book written a long time ago now, 30 years ago, very, very interesting book by a social scientist called Entertaining Ourselves to Death, where he, you know, predicted, he really nailed it on the head, that our whole culture now has become sort of defined by entertainment. Everything's just a form of entertainment. The news is a form of entertainment. You know, politics is a form of entertainment. It's kind of sad, but it still is, you know. It's just like, you know, what's going to keep me amused all the time? And the internet is kind of like one big possibility for keeping ourselves amused all the time. So we get diverted. We get diverted from what's important. So that's the second of the three obstacles to joyful effort in a spiritual life. And then the third one is a huge problem nowadays. Depression and low self-esteem. So 1,500 years ago or something, Shantideva identified this as a big problem when it comes to, you know, the really the the prioritizing and the energizing of your spiritual life is this kind of like feeling that you're no good. And I'll just tell you, you know, it's not about depression. These classes are not about depression, but I'll tell you the antidote to that in the text. I didn't include it in the reading. The antidote to low self-esteem and depression is to remember what they call your Buddha nature. Remember your capability. We all have infinite capability, and no one has more of that capability than anyone else. We all have it, and we all have it equally. We all have the potential to be fully awakened, to be fully enlightened. Okay? And you're supposed to kind of like, you're supposed to remember that and realize that the little person, the little self that you're feeling so bad about isn't the real you, actually. The real you lies at a deeper level. Okay? So, we all have tendencies this way towards low self-esteem. I read recently something like 1 in 10 Americans now are on some form of antidepressants. You know, it's a huge problem worldwide. So to remember our true nature, what we call our true nature, or your Buddha nature, or your true self, or something like that, that's the spiritual antidote to depression. Here's another one, okay, just practical, okay? Depression is a form of obsession about the self, obsession about your person, your personal self, your individual self. Anyone who's been depressed knows that when you're depressed, all you can think about is yourself and how bad you feel, right? So a very obvious kind of antidote to depression, and one that I learned actually originally from my psychiatrist. I was hospitalized for depression, and I went to a psychiatrist 3 or 4 times a week for 6 months or something, and he taught me this long ago, long before I was interested in the spiritual life. Think about somebody other than yourself. I remember, like, after 6 months of, therapy, I said, like, he said to me one day when I came in for the session, he says, how long are you going to come here? And I said, well, I don't know until you fix me, what do you mean? And he said, I was a young man and beginning my career, wasn't making that much money, living in New York City, cost of living was very high. I said, well, cost a lot of money to come here. I said, yeah, I know. And he says, yeah, and what about the effects on your family? Think about your family and how you're diverting funds and you're diverting time and, you're kind of a mess moping around the house. Think about somebody other than yourself. It's a very, very good advice. So anyway, those are 2 out of the 3. 2 out of the 3 obstacles to virya, to joyful effort, low self-esteem and getting diverted all the time by things that don't really matter that much. Then he says in the next verse, laziness arises due to inactivity, as we all know, right? That's kind of the obvious form of laziness. It's just this like sitting around on the couch all the time. Yeah, I'll get to the meditation class later. Kind of like, I'm tired right now. I don't feel like it. Had a long day. an appetite for pleasure. There's an English word for this. I don't know if you all know it. Hedonism. Hedonism means just thinking the whole purpose in life is to have pleasure all the time. And first of all, that's a fool's game. Because you'll never be able to do it. You'll never be able to just keep yourself pleasured all the time. Partly because there is no pleasure without pain. Okay? Pleasure is meaningless without its opposite. So, life is filled with these kinds of dualities. So this kind of like appetite for pleasure is a reason why we're lazy. We just want to have a good time, I don't want to like really work for much, that kind of feeling. Sleepiness and a craving for lying around brought about by what? Complacency regarding the suffering inherent in cyclical existence. Complacency regarding the fact that this life is filled with problems. And if you don't, like, prepare yourself for problems, when problems come, you have no resources. And the preparation for problems is a spiritual preparation. Okay? You know, it's very interesting. We have been kind of teaching for a long time and have students who have been around for, you know, years. 10 years. They've heard these kinds of classes over and over and over again. And it's just really interesting, like, when problems arise in their lives, it's like they never heard anything. It's like, you know, like they never heard 10 years of teaching. Like, how could this have happened to me? You know, my husband divorced me. How could this have happened to me? Well, this is samsara. This is the way it is in life. There are going to be problems in life. And I think sometimes people get the wrong idea about the purpose of a spiritual life. The purpose of a spiritual life is not to never have any problems. You know, to never have any external challenges, to never have people die on you, to never have health problems, to never lose your job. You see, that's not the purpose of it. Nobody can guarantee you that. See, this is the way it is in our world. This is the way it is in samsara. And the complacency can come equally from just not, like, you know, thinking about it, not wanting to think about it, or from thinking that the spiritual life will give you some kind of immunity from that. Those are two ways of talking about complacency, you see? Just not thinking, oh, this couldn't happen to me, or too bad that it happens to other people. Or thinking that, well, if I'm a good meditator, or if I do yoga 4 times a week, or, you know, if I really am a kind of a nice person in my life, that nothing bad will ever happen to me. Nothing unwanted will ever happen to me. That's naive at best. Okay? The purpose of a spiritual life is to prepare you for those kinds of eventualities so you don't just go, you know, kaput, so you don't go to pieces. If you don't have that kind of spiritual preparation, then you have no resources. You are at the mercy of the vicissitudes of life, the ups and downs of life. And so one way to think about the spiritual life is to learn how to have an even keel. You know that word? That expression, an even keel, so that you're not torpedoed by, you know, whatever life has around the corner for you. You know, next kind of disaster. We're all subject to this. Nobody is immune from it. So laziness here, he says, stems from a complacency about this kind of thing. And it's very easy to develop a complacency about this, about the realities of life, especially the, you know, being, living the kind of lives that most of us are living, you know? We're living in a kind of a bubble. You know? Designer samsara, sometimes they call it. Designer samsara. Where, you know, you have plenty to eat, you've got 300 channels on the TV, you've got nice new cars that you're driving around in a beautiful, glitzy city, 8 zillion kinds of cuisines to choose from. And you think, wow, you know, it's pretty good. You know, why would I have to, like, discipline myself to, you know, live a spiritual life? You know, things are going well. Until they're don't. See, until they don't. And it's not, you know, like, again, the expression, it's not, you know, if there's going to be disaster, when? We all have disasters in our lives. And nobody's immune from it. Nobody's immune from death. Nobody's immune from sickness. Nobody's immune from old age. Nobody's immune from these kinds of things. Nobody's immune from, like, losing your bank account. You see, that could happen. All kinds of things can happen. And it doesn't just happen to other people. So that's a little, like, you know, kind of sermon about complacency. We're all liable to it. We all are, as long as things are going well, we can lull ourselves into this kind of complacency and then postpone the priorities in life. I'll get to it later, you know. Right now, you say, things are good. Why should I, like, waste my time going to yoga classes or meditating or stuff like that? I don't need it. You see? Until you do. And if you haven't practiced, if you haven't prioritized it, if you haven't put your joyful effort behind it, then you have no resources. When the disaster happens, you have no resources. So the next section Cindy will do is, you know, how to help, like, really put some jet fuel behind that kind of motivation, and to get over the laziness, get over the complacency.
I think, did you talk about how laziness and busyness were the same thing?
I didn't.
No, okay. So I think we talked about that a little bit yesterday, though, because as Marit said, one of the obstacles to having joyful effort is laziness. And because this is a get unbusy talk, we remind ourselves of what we talked about yesterday, about the fact that busyness and laziness are actually the same thing.
It's a form of laziness.
Yeah.
Busyness is a form of laziness. Because it doesn't... It again is a kind of an obstacle for us when it comes to prioritization.
Yeah.
If we keep busy all the time, then we don't stop to think about, well, what is really important? What should I really be, you know, kind of throwing my relatively limited resources of time and energy and so forth? What should I be throwing that towards? Just keep busy so you don't have to think.
Right. And so this next section of keeping your priorities straight, I just wanted to stall out quickly on another way that we keep ourselves busy. Because I think this class is called Organizing Activities or something like that. You know, getting organized.
Yeah, getting organized.
And so I just wanted to stall out for a brief moment on multitasking, which is another way that we stay busy, right? Is that we multitask. And the funny thing about multitasking is that you think you're being really efficient, but studies show that you're being very inefficient. So multitasking is basically doing too many things at once and not doing anything properly. So, you know, you go into the kitchen to make lunch, and you start, like, cooking something for lunch, and you know it's going to take a while for the onions to brown, and so you think, oh, I'll also fold the laundry. So you run into the laundry and you start folding the laundry, you know, and then you run back to the onions and you realise, oh my God, there's something on the floor. I better go and get the vacuum cleaner, and I start doing that. The onions are burning. Oh my God, the onions are burning. Try and make the lunch, and then you realise you haven't set the table, and so you run back to the laundry and you open the cupboard and all the laundry falls on your head because you haven't put it away properly, you know. This is the multitasking. You think that you're doing everything at once, but actually nothing's being done properly, right? Nothing's folded properly, nothing's put away properly, nothing's cooked properly, the table's not set, your whole life is messy, unorganised, you know, and you've forgotten the things that you have done, you haven't done them properly, and so on. So we think that we're being really efficient, but actually multitasking is very inefficient. So it's the idea that we're enriching our lives, but there's an underlying sort of poverty to it. Trying to fill it up with busyness, trying to fill it up with accomplishment, but actually you're not accomplishing anything really. And that's not to say, you know, that you sit there and you just cook and you just stand there staring at the pan and don't do it. You know what I mean? Like, we're being like realistic about it, you know. Just doing the onions. But, or, you know, I've put the rice cooker on and I'm just going to stand there for 20 minutes not doing anything else, you know. I'm being realistic. But recognising the underlying poverty and desperation behind your multitasking. And I wanted to read you this quote from Clifford Nash, a professor of communication at Stanford University. He says, "The research is almost unanimous, which is very rare in social science. And it says that people who chronically multitask show an enormous range of deficits. They're basically terrible at all sorts of cognitive tasks, including multitasking." So if you're overly multitasking, you're actually really bad even at multitasking, because your attention is dispersed. Like I said, you can't filter out irrelevancy. You untrain yourself in how to concentrate. You know, you untrain yourself. So people who multitask can't filter out irrelevancy, can't manage a working memory, are chronically distracted, are unable to have awareness of others. This is really interesting, I think. So that would be when you're having lunch with your friend and she's telling you something and you're like, you know. So you're multitasking in the sense of having lunch with your friend and checking your phone at the same time, which is a quality of somebody who doesn't have any emotional intelligence, by the way, that you don't have the ability to concentrate on other people and listen to them, that you've got half your mind on the phone means that you have also untrained yourself how to be emotionally engaging and intelligent towards other people, you know? So multitasking makes us sort of socially inept. It doesn't sound very good, does it? You can't keep on task, and in fact, some people, they say that it can lower your IQ to something of an eight-year-old child. So the next time you're writing your boss an email during a meeting, remember that your cognitive capacity is being diminished to the point that you might as well let an eight-year-old write it for you.
I read recently that somebody did a study that proved that people high on marijuana actually had more attention than most people who are multitasking type people. Well, I mean, you know, if you've ever been high on marijuana, you can see how that's possible, right? We're not recommending it. Especially not in Singapore.
So, yeah, multitasking, especially with others present, indicates low self-awareness and social awareness. Low self-awareness and social awareness. So you don't have good awareness about yourself and your own ability to be present, and you don't have awareness on others and what they need, which is the two foundations of living a good spiritual life, right? Having good self-awareness and other awareness. Basically, recognizing the interconnection of self and others is one of your main anchors of living a good life. And multitasking completely destroys those two anchors. And I think with the phone too, one of the things that we can be careful of is the fact that those of us on social media, and I'm not telling people to get off social media. I'm on social media, you know, I'm not saying that. But to have some awareness around what it is that you're doing, particularly around the, if you have the continual need to frame your experience through photographing it and putting it online, to just think about what that does to your perception of your life, that you're continually framing your experience. So you're having a good moment and immediately you need to frame it, you know, box it in and upload it and have affirmation that it was a good moment, a memorable moment, you know. You know that saying, if a tree falls in the woods and nobody hears it, did it make a sound? If you have an amazing experience and you don't photograph it, did it happen? No. We kind of got into this thing of like, I have to photograph everything, I have to remember everything, I have to frame everything. So it's really interesting that it's you're framing something in and boxing it in and trying to present it, packaging it out, marketing it, you know, marketing your experiences. And it's nice to detox from that need to continually frame your experience through capturing it, photographing it and getting immediate feedback on it. I think that's a healthy way to live, to not be too addicted to that feedback and that need to frame. Because also, you know, talking about your self-awareness and other awareness, how does that change the good moment? Did you stop the good moment by photographing it? Did the people having the good moment with you stop their good moment by you photographing them, you know? So had to have a little bit more awareness about how that need to photograph and frame and present everything online, how that changes your experience of reality. I think, you know, there's also a saying like, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. And Mick Jagger says, what happens in Vegas now ends up on Instagram 10 minutes later. So keep some things staying in Vegas, you know. Doesn't have to all get out there immediately. Okay, so getting your priorities straight. So Liberty Shantideva, you know, says you're not having joyful effort in your life because you're lazy and you have an attraction to distracting things and you have low self-esteem. And so, of course, Shantideva says, what are you doing? You're dying. You know, if this was your last day to live, your priorities would be quite clear, wouldn't they? Or if you knew you had a week to live, your priorities would get quite clear. So Shantideva sort of brings that into the present to say, well, you are dying. Not if I was dying, you are dying. You know, we're all, as soon as we're born, we start dying. Isn't that interesting? As soon as we're born, we start dying. And so this should be a galvanizing force for us. Recognizing death is not morbid. It's actually a way to get very clear on our priorities and have that be something that really energizes us for doing what needs to be done. Getting out of complacency, as Marit said, the antidote. Today there may be health, enjoyment, and no problems, but life is fleeting and deceptive, and the body is on loan. Your body is a rental, and you have to return it to the rental, the costume shop, at some point, you know. And it's impermanent. Life is impermanent. Your body is impermanent. Your relationships are impermanent, and so on. So getting clear. Why is life deceptive? What's deceptive about life? I was thinking that what's deceptive is that we think that things that don't matter that much matter a lot, and that we think that, and things that do matter, we don't think matter that much. So that's why life's deceptive, because things that don't really matter that much, we think they matter a lot, like replying to emails, going on Facebook, you know, all of the ways we've been talking about distracting ourselves from our dharma, they actually don't matter that much. Or all of the churning in the mind about what he said to me last week or what he said to me 20 years ago, actually, for some of us, right? Still churning on that argument of what they said to me 20 years ago, and if I ever see them again, not, I haven't seen them in 20 years, but if I do, I know exactly what I'm going to say to them because I've rehearsed it over and over again. But it doesn't matter. It's not important now, you know? So we think that the things that don't really matter that much, we put great importance on them. We put so much energy into them. And things that do matter, like the fact that we're dying, we might not think about all day. So we think about what they said to me 20 years ago all day, but we don't think about the fact that life is impermanent all day. So that's why life's deceptive. So we don't prioritize what's important. Body's on loan. And we'll go through the death awareness meditation very quickly in a second. That is why the Blessed One said that a human birth is very hard to obtain, as rare as a turtle who just happens to stick its neck into the opening of a yolk floating in the great sea. This is a very famous metaphor that that you'd see in the Buddhist tradition about how precious it is to receive the life that we did, this precious human life, with all the resources and opportunities given to us on a platter, all of our health, our prosperity, our cognitive abilities to study the Dharma, you know, our body's all okay, we can meditate, we can do walking meditation, sitting meditation, we can do yoga, we have texts from all spiritual traditions available on the internet. It's crazy how blessed we are with this life, and it's so rare to find. If you believe in reincarnation, and you can think about how many lives you've lived this life already, you know, you could listen to Bob Thurman recently. He's been going off on this sort of thing about how strange it is that people couldn't say that definitely there's no rebirth, because he said like, no one can come back from nothingness and say, no, there's definitely no rebirth. Anyway. No one comes back from nothingness to say, no, I was right, there's nothing when you die. So, but anyway, the point is that we should consider it like it's as rare as if there's a turtle that's swimming in the vast ocean and there's one little golden hoop in the middle of the ocean, and that turtle just manages to come up. Every 100 years only it comes up, and as it comes up it manages to stick its head through that little gold hoop in the whole vastness of the ocean. That's how rare your life is. And isn't that a nice way to think of your life? That we wake up grateful every morning to say, oh my God, I woke up again. My health is here. My cognitive capabilities are still here. I have food, loved ones, you know, waking up grateful. And then you also realize that it's so rare to find, and time is running out. So you wake up grateful, recognizing your leisure and fortune, your spiritual resources and opportunities. So amazing that I have the capability to really follow my Sanatana Dharma this lifetime. There's so many people that want to and they can't. There are so many people that want to and they can't, I tell you. You know, a lot of people want to live a spiritual life and they cannot do it for all kinds of reasons. we managed to make it here today. You know, whenever we make it to a teaching, it's insane. Whenever we make it to the meditation cushion, it's amazing, you know. It's as rare as the turtle sticking its head through that, you know, so we should feel grateful for that. And then we realize, but time's running out. So then we can do the death awareness meditation. And so having obtained a momentary opportunity like this, because part of Leisure and Fortune is saying it's so rare to find, but time is running out. It's for a limited time only. Were I not to use it to practice virtue, there would be no greater betrayal, no greater foolishness. So you can think about all those people that do wish to live a spiritual life, that do wish to practice, looking at you, you know, watching Big Brother on television and saying, oh my God, I can't believe they're not doing something, you know, that's of benefit. I'd be doing something of benefit if I had their life. So think, it would be no greater betrayal for towards them, you know, that we were given that and we didn't use it. So we'll do the brief death awareness meditation, or yeah.
You want to do it as a meditation? Or you want to just talk about it?
How's everyone feeling? Tired? Alive?
Get up and stretch or something.
Well,
we do a meditation.
Yeah. If you can lead it, you lead it. So, yeah. So everybody, just get up for a second.
Standing down.
If you need, yeah. No, just to wake up. Just to wake up. I know it's hot. You can do your little body slap. I like this. It wakes all up. Or do like Angie and hang off the wall a bit.
Many of you know this meditation already, right? Just a review for a lot of people.
But it's a good one to do every morning when you wake up, so getting your priorities straight when you wake. Okay.
All right. So this is I'll just do the really quick, done and dirty one. But as Cindy said, I've been recommending for years, and I did this myself as a practice for many, many years, to do some version of this every morning before you get out of bed. So we'll do the easiest form of it, okay? It comes actually in a 12-part meditation, a 9-part meditation. We'll do the 3-part meditation. So just relax, close your eyes. Concentrate on your breath for just a minute, just to get your mind focused. Just watch your breath go in and out of the nostril. Try to get like as interested in your breathing as you would be going to the latest 3D movie. The Martian. Try to get as interested in your breath as you are in The Martian when you go to see The Martian. Is that plain and simple? So in Tibetan Buddhism, one of the types of meditation is called an analytical meditation. So we'll do it like that. So you analyze. You analyze in this meditation. So the first thing we'll analyze is, will I die? And use the first person pronoun as you're thinking about it. Will I die? What do you think? One way to think about, you know, an analytical way of coming at it is to think, well, you know, have other people I've known died? Think about the people that you've known who've already died, who've already passed away. Are you different from them somehow? And it doesn't take too long to, intellectually at least, maybe not deeply, but intellectually, to realize, of course I'll die. That my death is certain. So just try to hold your mind on that fact. My death is certain. Secondly, analyze. Do you know when you're going to die? Do you have any guarantees? Maybe you think, well, I'm lead a healthy lifestyle. I do a lot of exercise. I don't eat bad foods or something like that. But do you have any guarantees that you won't die from one of the many, many, many ways that could kill you? Accidents, cancer erupting, murder. I had a friend who was murdered when he was 15 years old, a very close friend of mine. All kinds of ways that you can die. Do you know when you're going to die? So then hold your mind on the fact that the time of your death is uncertain, is absolutely uncertain. The time of your death is unpredictable. None of us know how much longer we have to live. And then thirdly, analyze. What's going to be important when I die? What will matter? What will matter? And then you can review all the kinds of things that, you know, we sort of think that matters in life when we're not thinking about our lives in relation to the certainty of our death and the uncertainty of the time of our death. Things that we think matter are our jobs, our money, our possessions, our entertainment, our relationships. You know, there's an expression, we're working on our relationship. You know? All of that work on relationships, all of that time spent on the job, all the, you know, time making money and making investments and saving and buying stuff, all that will matter not a bit. So then another part of this third part is to think what will matter. What will matter? What will matter is, did you do your best to live a good life? Did you do your best to live a life that you, the kind of life that you know you really should live? A decent life, an honest life, a life of service to others, a life in which you were part of the solution instead of part of the problem. That's going to be the only thing that really is going to matter at the end. So hold your mind on that. Then as a way to move into the prioritization that we've been talking about in this class, resolve to start prioritizing what's really going to matter when you die now, to prioritize it now, to start living a life now that you can be proud of when you die, and you don't know when that will be. Maybe think about little adjustments that you can make. Little resolutions on how to live a little bit differently, a little bit better, a little bit more according to your ideals, spiritual ideals, so that you can die without regret. Everyone got the three parts? Everyone, a lot of people know this meditation, right? My death is certain. The time of death is uncertain. And what's going to matter when I die? Those are the three parts of the meditation. And then the resolution at the end is kind of important too. Start doing what's going to matter when you die. Start doing it now. So the next part I'll do rather quickly because I'm going to do a whole evening teaching on it on Tuesday of this coming week, from victimhood to mastery at Cocoon Yoga Studio. Everyone know where that is? So the part here in the handout is knowing when to act and when to relax. And the verse associated with that is a very famous verse from the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, a verse that you all, many of you are familiar with. If there's something you can do about it, why stress out? If there's something you can do about something, what's the point of stressing out? Just do it. Like Nike used to say, just do it. Do they still say it? Just do it. My brother-in-law works for Nike, I should know. I think they still say that, yeah. If there's something you can do about it, there's no point in stressing. That doesn't help you get it done. Just do it. If there's something you can do about it, then what's the next part? If there's nothing you can do about it, why stress out? There's nothing you can do about it. What's the point of stressing out? So this is a great verse. I love this verse. When does Shantideva say that we can stress out? Never. Okay, there's never a point, there's never any time in life where it makes any sense to stress out. If there's something you can do, then just do it. Don't stress out about it. And if there's nothing you can do, what's the point of stressing out about it? You see? Here's an example. So the key is to know the difference between when there's something you can do about it and when there's nothing that you can do about it. Here's one very good example. You ever have experience of being stuck in traffic in Singapore at all? Is there something that you can do when you're stuck in traffic? Okay, but many, many people, myself included, I feel it. Like, it's when I get stuck in traffic, you can start feeling it. You know, it's all this stress starts coming up. And it's completely irrational. There's nothing you can do about it. So just relax already. All right, and there's lots of situations like that in life. I'll talk more about them on Tuesday. And if there's something you can do about it, well, then just get busy. Don't. I mean, in the good sense, you know what I mean? Okay. So one of the things that we can do something about is the pace of our lives. The pace. The tempo of our lives. We can control that. We can't necessarily control the things that we need to do in the course of a day, but we can control the pace in which we do them. You see the difference? You see what I'm saying? We can do them mindfully and peacefully, or we can do them like a chicken with its head cut off. We are in control of that. There's something that we can do about the pace of our lives. As part of the research for this course, I went on the internet. I found an article by someone named Hannah Rosin, R-O-S-I-N, and it's entitled, "You Are Not as Busy as You Say You Are." Very interesting article. She says, the art of busyness, okay, this is kind of related to the cult of busyness or the disease of the art of busyness, is to convey genuine alarm at the pace of your life. Oh my God, I'm so busy, you know? To convey genuine alarm at the busy pace of your life. And a helpless resignation, as if someone else is setting the clock. You know, I can't do anything about it. I'm so busy, and this is just kind of forced on me somehow. all these things I have to do, as if someone else were setting the clock, and yet simultaneously make it clear that you are at the top of your game. Oh, I can handle it, you know. I'm so busy, and I'm not in control of my life, and I have so many things that are being imposed on me, but I can all handle it somehow, right? Make it clear you are at the top of your game. To be deep in the overwhelm. Overwhelm has become a noun. The overwhelm. It's not only a verb now, the overwhelm. You know, we're all overwhelmed. So we're in the overwhelm. To be deep in the overwhelm requires not just doing too many things in one 24-hour period. Not just that. But doing so many different kinds of things that they all blend into each other. And a day has no sense of distinct phases. Very keen observation. Like there's no time off. You see, there's no time when you go to work and then that's delineated, you know, and comes to an end, and then you go home and have leisure, and that comes to an end, and then you sleep. And it's all just kind of free flow now. It's all just flowed into one another. And that's a decision. That is something we can control. So, you know, we all have many of us have jobs, many of us have things to do. But we can decide when, you know, to some extent, we can decide when we're not going to work, when we're not going to keep, when we are going to, like, interact with our families, fully. We can decide the pacing of our lives. You know, we have different things that we need to do in life, but it's all kind of merged into this one big, kind of seamless, busy, you know, kind of day. So that's one way of thinking about what we can control. We can't maybe necessarily control the responsibilities that we have. You know, they come to us. So we, you know, can't stress out about it because there's nothing you can do about that. But what we can do something about, so no stress on that, is to be able to make decisions about the phasing of our day, the phases of our day. You see what I mean? Everyone understand what I'm talking about? It doesn't seem like it. Maybe it's become like such a phenomenon that we don't even know what we're talking about here anymore. There is a time when you can punch into work. You know, they used to have these clocks where you punched in. You still understand that expression? Punch in, and then you can also decide when to punch out. Okay? And then truly, like, enjoy your leisure, or truly enjoy the time with your friends or your family. But the idea that the clock is kind of always running has become a phenomenon in our lives, where we don't have any kind of phases or tempos anymore. It's all just one kind of flow of busyness. So anyway, That's enough maybe on that verse. To know which is which. If there's something you can do about it, why stress out? And if there's nothing you can do about it, why stress out? And to know which is which. One more thing about that, and this is something I'll talk about a lot on Tuesday. What, in general, what we cannot control is external events. Okay? What we can control is our internal responses. Okay? And so that's another way to think about which is which. And in either case, there's no sense in stressing out. No sense in stressing out about what you can't control, the flow of the external events in your life. And there's no sense in not taking control of what you can take into control. And that is your internal life, your spiritual life, your inner life. And so we'll explore that more on Tuesday. There was a comment earlier at the class about another aspect of why many of us are so busy, and that is that we don't say no enough. Okay, so maybe the mantra for today. What was the mantra yesterday? It's just a job. Om, it's just a job. Okay, so here's a mantra for people who say, who who say yes too much. You know? Can you do this? Yes, yes, I'll do that. Can you do this? Can you take this on? Yes, 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 yes. Okay, so say om.
Oh.
No. Don't say yes to everything. You know, this is part of prioritizing, you know? We only have a certain amount of time in life. We only have a certain amount of time in the day. So, you know, it's important to learn how to say no, not nicely. You don't have to say it like I just did. Say, no, sorry. Okay, maybe that's better, okay? No, sorry. Okay? But to learn how to say no. So these are some verses about making commitments that you can keep. Because if you say yes to everything, you're not going to keep all your commitments. And that's automatically stress reducing. Because you said you were going to do something and then you realize you can't do it. You don't have time to do it, or you don't have the energy, or you don't have the interest, but you said yes, and you feel guilty, and you know, it's kind of a cycle like that. This is from the guide. Before beginning, take stock of your resources and then decide whether to undertake a project or not. So before you say yes, you say, well, do I have enough time to do this? Do you know? And if you realize that you don't, then you say, om, no. Right?
Sorry, no.
It's very interesting, you know, Shanti Davis says, you know, says, the next part is, it's better not to begin at all than to quit something you started. Okay? So over committing, saying yes all the time, means that there's going to be a certain amount of things that you never actually, you know, finish, that you never actually kind of get to or finish. So he says, better not to even begin than to begin and then quit. And then the next verse says, why? This habit of not doing what you say you will extends into future lives. And because of this vice, he calls it a vice, one's suffering increases. Another timely opportunity to act is wasted, and what needs to be done is left accomplished.
Unaccomplished.
So not doing what you say you're going to do becomes a habit. If you say you're going to do everything, if you keep saying yes, yes, yes to everything, you will not do what you say you're going to do. Because you can't do everything you said yes to. And then that becomes a habit. And that habit actually, not doing what you say you're going to do, is related in the Buddhist texts to what's called idle speech. Idle speech, one of the, you know, 10 major misdeeds. You know, it's just saying you're going to do something and not do it is a form of idle speech. And the karmic correlation of idle speech, you know, what's the fruit, the karmic result of doing this kind of making promises that you can't keep. Very interesting. Low self-esteem. And it makes total sense, doesn't it? Because you say you're going to do something, you see yourself not doing it, and you feel like, you know, you're just trash. You're talking trash, and therefore you feel like trash. See? You talk rubbish, and then the karma comes back at you as feeling rubbish. So do what you say you're going to do, but don't say you're going to do everything. Mm-hmm. Prioritize it. Mm-hmm. What's important to do? What's important to say yes to? And what's important to say om, no, sorry to? Right? Very important verses here. Very important verses on, you know, prioritization, and also to a very practical kind of, you know, advice on how to feel less busy in life, is to not take on too much. But also, keep in mind, to complete what it is that you do take on, which builds self-esteem. Have you noticed? Yeah. If you've said you're going to do something and you bring that to completion, it makes you feel good. It makes you feel more capable. It makes you feel more able to, you know, to do things like that in the future and so forth. It builds kind of capability muscles. Yeah.
You feel like you have the power to make things happen, you know? Your body, speech, and mind are in harmony, like you have a thought to do something and then you say you'll do it and then you actually do it. Then this whole kind of like body, speech and mind is in harmony and has power to make things happen. And I think that's that is actually part of the Dharma, is that you have wisdom and you have compassion and you have power. So really in this activity that you really gain that strength to have power to make things happen. And Sana, when you were talking about it in terms of the yoga, I think this is regular feeling for people in the Dharma, especially from the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. It's interesting that it's in this text, because I think people that are trying to live life in service to others as bodhisattvas, you do think that's the correct thing to do, is to take on as much as possible, which is right. You go to your edge, right? And you do things where it's uncomfortable, it'll take away time and everything, and that's bodhisattva activity, where you work at your edge of self-cherishing and that kind of thing. But then you can also think, well, sometimes when I say yes to things, it's to look good. It's to look like a bodhisattva, when actually I have to say no, but it looks bad, you know, and I worry what people will think of me, I won't look like a good bodhisattva, and so on. So it's actually humbling to, you know, to say no sometimes. It doesn't seem like it's the right thing to do. You know, it's quite challenging to hear that, but I think that that's maybe part of the bodhisattva activity too, is to recognize your limitations. Yeah. Yeah, Tom.
But why would it extend into your future lives?
It just becomes a habit. That's what he's saying. It just becomes a habit. And that's kind of what karma is. Karma creates just a groove, habitual groove. So you fall into it over and over and over.
And you see the results. Like if you keep saying to someone, oh, I'll call you, and that you never call, then you become the person that just says stuff that doesn't mean anything. You know it, they know it, and that extends through your life as the Tom's the unreliable guy that, like, may turn up, may not, never know. Yeah. Jung said, you are what you do, not what you say you'll do. Gandhi said, whatever you do will be insignificant, but it's very important that you do it. Right, the little things, very important that we do it. It builds integrity, right, to do what you say you're going to do. One kindness is worth a million good ideas. My mum and I were discussing this recently, how we have a lot of good ideas to do stuff for other people, but you don't do them. You know, so you sort of have this little hit of how awesome you are to have all these kind thoughts, but you don't do them, you know. It's not very kind, right? So one kindness is worth a million good ideas. So making commitments you can keep means you're taking stock of your resources and so on. You know your Dharma, you know your priorities, you work out whether or not you can do it. And then the next part is, then you just do it. Like, go for it. We let a lot of doubt creep in and the multitasking and the busyness, and like Marit said again, you've got that one thing you said you were going to do and then the whole house gets spotless. You do all the other things that's not that one thing that you said you were going to do. I actually also thought of, you know, the verse I was reading before from the Bhagavad Gita about doing your own duty, rather doing your own duty poorly rather than another's duty well. The story around that actually is also that that Arjuna, who's a warrior, you know, he said to Krishna, oh, maybe, you know, he's in a big bind, right? He's on the battlefield, he's in a big bind. And he, you know, he says to Krishna, oh, I might become a renunciate. He's in the middle of a battle, and that's his duty, is to sort of deal with what's happening in the present for him. The uncomfortable thing that's happening for him in the present is that there's a very difficult, challenging situation for this warrior. And then he starts thinking, oh, maybe I'll become a renunciate, you know, go out into the cave and start meditating. And so Krishna's like, what are your responsibilities here, you know? We have this great diversionary tactics to not do what our duty is. And I thought that was kind of interesting too, in terms of, you know, your spiritual life, is to know, to take responsibility and know when the appropriate time is to do the appropriate actions. So the next verses are actually quite interesting. So once we've agreed to do something, you just do it. And the title here is being intoxicated with what you are doing. So listen to this. You should be addicted to whatever action you undertake. Like someone who craves the thrill that comes from playing a game, you should be insatiable and intoxicated with that action. So Shanti Deva's being really challenging here. He's been kind of you know,
provocative,
because these words are all banned in Buddhism, you know. Addicted, craving, intoxication, these are all words that you're sort of supposed to think, oh my God, that's really bad. But he's saying, be addicted, be intoxicated with the action that you're doing. Be addicted to whatever action you undertake. So it's quite interesting that he's using that language, because if you really think of an addict, they put their heart and soul, right? If you've been addicted, we're all addicted, okay? We're all addicted to something. So think about what it is that you're addicted to and how you put your heart and soul and your full concentration and your, like, incredible mindfulness. Don't even need to practice, right? But incredible mindfulness, concentration into getting that thing that you're addicted to, right? So we're all got the great ability to put our heart and soul into things, and we all know it, that because we're all addicted to things, and we put our heart and soul into it. Like, I used to think about how when, you know, I used to go to raves, and I used to be, like, obsessed with organising, going to the rave, and what am I going to wear, and, you know, what are we going to do there, and how are we going to get there, and you spend weeks organising it, and you're just addicted to it. And imagine putting that energy into meditation, you know. What time am I going to meditate? What am I going to wear? What kind of tea should I drink? Should I drink chamomile or peppermint? Which is going to make me high or low, you know? Just the way that you would go to a rave. You organise all of the stimulants and everything, you know? So the thing that you're addicted to, you put all the energy into that, and then meditation, you're like, meh, I might sit, I might not, whatever. So if you've decided that you're going to do it, be like an addict. For, and because we did joyful effort, it's joy in doing things that are going to be of benefit for yourself and others, right? We've clarified in joyful effort, it's joy in doing good things. So we're just moving the substance that you're addicted to things that are of benefit. And can't we put our back behind achieving that? But he also uses the language, the thrill. Craves the thrill that comes from playing a game. So that's the joyful part of joyful effort, you know. Like you're playing a game. We'll talk about this tomorrow. Like work as art, life as play. We can have that sort of joy and thrill that comes from playing a game or running a race, or have some enjoyment as part of it. It doesn't have to be so serious. Every action is performed with the hope that it will bring about happiness, even though that happiness may or may not come about. But how can an action bring about happiness if no action at all is performed? So you play the game like a race, you know. It won't bring about happiness definitely if you don't do it. I'll finish it off here. And so when a job has been completed, you should throw yourself into another task, just as an elephant who is sweltering in the midday sun immediately plunges into a lake. I love this image. A big elephant just plunging itself into a lake. And in the Tao Te Ching, it says something that reminded me of this verse. Therefore, the master acts without doing anything and teaches without saying anything. Things arise and she lets them come. Things disappear and she lets them go. She has but doesn't possess, acts but doesn't expect. When her work is done, she forgets it. That is why it lasts forever. So when a job has been completed, you should throw yourself into another task immediately. Here they're really talking about this idea that, I don't know if you know the Zen teacher Shunrei Suzuki, but he talks about once you've done something, you burn yourself like a bonfire. You don't stink it up by sticking around like, hey, did you notice that I did that thing I told you I was going to do? You don't stay. You don't stench up the activity by staying and making it all about you. You immediately, insatiably, with great, you know, intoxication, move on to the next task that you've promised to do. Van Morrison says, the point of jazz is you do something and then you go on. So, like work as play, life as art, your work is like music. You do something and then you go on. You know, you don't like play jazz and then go, oh, did you hear that? You know? Oh, did you hear that bit? Right, you're doing it and then you go on, you move on. You don't stink it up with how awesome you are about it. So Shunrei Suzuki says, in order not to leave any traces when you do something, you should do it with your whole body and mind. You should be concentrated on what you do. You should do it completely, like a good bonfire. You should not be a smoky fire. You should burn yourself completely. If you do not burn yourself completely, a trace of yourself will be left in what you do. You will have something remaining which is not completely burnt out. Zen activity is activity which is completely burned out with nothing remaining. When you do something, you should burn yourself up completely like a good bonfire, leaving no trace of yourself. It's like no trace, no self, no problem. It's swift like the wind, moving swiftly like the wind. And when your strength begins to decline, you should quit so that you can re-engage later. We'll talk about this tomorrow. When the job has been completed well, you should leave it and move on with a craving for more and more. So we'll talk about this also on the fourth class, that there's a Buddha of activity and they're like that. They're actually moved by the element of wind, which means that the karma family is a family of Buddhas that moves as swiftly at the wind, accomplishing the needs of all living beings while simultaneously recognizing that everything is already accomplished. Everything is already accomplished in one sense of reality. There's nothing to do in one sense of reality, and so we do while knowing that everything is already done.
So having prioritized, you know, what it is that important to do, then you throw yourself into it wholeheartedly. That's the point here, right? But, you know, you have to sort of first know what's important to throw yourself into wholeheartedly. But once that decision is made, once the priorities have been set, then really go for it. That's the point here. All right, in 5 minutes, or a few more maybe, last section. What about doing things that you don't want to do, but you have to do? There are things like, everyone agree, there are things like that in life. We have a half an acre in the country, and every couple of weeks the lawn needs mowing. And I don't like mowing lawn. You know, it's a lot of work. It takes me like 3 hours. It's really hard work, you know, pushing the lawnmower around, even though it's electric like that. But it has to be done. You know, somebody's got to do it. And I'm the owner, so I guess it's me. So how do you have that, how do you maintain at least some form of that kind of joyful effort in doing things that you don't really want to do? So these are the last verses here, today's class. Here's the first bit of advice. There is nothing whatsoever that remains difficult if one practices discipline. Abhyasa. If you do it over and over and over again, it gets easier. And that's true. That's true with anything, right? It's true with mowing the lawn. It's true with doing your yoga. It's true with learning a musical instrument. If you practice over and over again, it gets easier. So that's the first bit of advice. And then he says, is it really that onerous? Is it really that, like, big deal? Don't you regard as insignificant the suffering that comes from things like bugs, flies, and mosquitoes, hunger and thirst, or things like the itch of a rash? You know, why are you making a big deal about it? It's just the lawn. Mow the goddamn lawn, you know? Don't sit around like saying, oh, I wish I didn't have to do this, and, you know, what a big deal. You know, just do it. I should not be soft on myself when faced with things like heat or cold, rain and wind, sickness or imprisonment, and torches. Now he's kind of getting a little more medieval, since it only makes it worse. So even the worst of our tasks, complaining doesn't help. If you have to do it, you know, even when it's very, very difficult or very, you know, kind of, you know, something you really, really don't want to do, complaining about it makes it even worse, he says. Some people, when they see their own blood, rise to the occasion. You know, like, he's talking here about warriors or maybe like boxers. You know, sometimes, you know, in a boxing match or something, when some guy, you know, kind of gets cut and he starts to, like, feel his, he gets even more stoked. It's even more kind of thing. Some people, when they see their own blood, they rise, they get, while other people faint even when they see another person's blood. So it's a decision. It's a mental decision. That's kind of what he's saying, you know? All this derives from either mental resolution or faint-heartedness. And so, one should overcome pain and become invulnerable to suffering. So, be tough, he says, okay? You know, there are things in life that we have to do that we don't want to do. But you have to do them. So, you know, man up, woman up, you know, and just do it. Be a warrior. And besides, he says, here's the last thing, okay? There are good things about suffering. Because of it, I lose my pride. So, you know, there, you know, now he's kind of really talking about not just, you know, how to do things that we don't want to do, but advice for turning even the biggest disasters into opportunities to grow, spiritual growth. So even the worst kinds of disasters that befall you can be transformed. So how? He says, well, number one, disasters help us lose our pride. Oh, I somehow thought that a disaster like this could never happen to someone like me. You see, that's pride. Thinking that you're special, that you know you're somehow invulnerable or special or privileged, so that disasters somehow shouldn't happen to you. So when they do, then you start to, you know, kind of, you're taken down a notch. You know that expression? So you lose your pride. It brings compassion for those in the cycle of suffering. When a disaster happens to us, we only then can really have compassion for others who have been in that same disaster. Because now it's happened to us. Now we know how it feels. See? You lose a loved one. You know, people have been losing loved ones all around you all the time. And you say, oh, that's too bad for them, you know? But when you lose your loved one, then, oh, now I really know how it feels. See, any disaster can be turned into, you know, he's talking about various ways of turning them into something positive. This is, in some ways, the most easiest and important, is that it can generate real compassion for the suffering of others, because now you know really how it feels. This requires also that you realize that it's not just you, you know, who lost a loved one or suddenly doesn't, you know, lost their health or something like that. People are losing their health and losing their loved ones all the time. Not just you. You see, that's another form of pride. You see, to be in the midst of a disaster and think, this is so unfair. This is, I'm the only one somehow that, you know, is in this bad thing. You know, of course you're not. Right? Suffering is ubiquitous. Suffering happens to everyone, you know, universally. So use it as an opportunity to generate some compassion. Fear of doing bad things, you know, this kind of refers to karma, you know. Every sort of like difficult thing happens to us because we've created the causes and conditions for it. So you can think about causality when it comes to disaster. And then finally, a longing to be a conqueror, a longing to be a Buddha, so you don't have these kind of like problems anymore. So you can stimulate, you know, this kind of a spiritual motivation to really work hard for the ultimate result of a spiritual life. So the last verse here, you know, you can summarize them. Never let a good disaster go to waste. I mean, disasters actually are very, very important opportunities for us to think about, like, our spiritual lives, to think about how we can transform potentially anything in life. You see, there are no problems out there. Problems are interpretations. Problems are interpretations of an event. It's just an event. So if you reinterpret the event, it no longer is a problem. If you can see something useful in an event, it is no longer a problem. All right, let's take a break. The exercise, by the way, for this class is to review the death awareness meditation that we did. And we'll take a break now and meet again at 7 for the third class.